Right. So then, before we begin, why don't we all take a moment to pay homage? To the most magnificent one, the unparalleled one, the undefeated and the unvanquished one, he who is our guide, our master, the greatest teacher that mankind has ever seen, as he has the path to our deliverance, to free us all from suffering. And as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that that is our purpose here. We are not just here because we have nothing better to do on a Sunday morning, but we are here to free ourselves from all suffering. So with that in mind, this is not just a reverence to the Supremely Enlightened One, but also a pledge, an oath, to free ourselves from suffering.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
If you were to ask someone, what is the teaching of the Buddhas? Most people would refer to his first discourse. In the first discourse, which is the Dhamma Chakra Pavattana Sutta, also called the Dhamma Wheel, turning discourse, you know that he expounded what we have today come to know as the Four Noble Truths. Now, if you take any good book written on Buddhist philosophy, then there will be those among you who might have done quite a bit of study in Buddhist philosophy and the teachings of the Buddha. There have been many a good book written on Buddhist teachings and scriptures and so on. On your initial inspection, it might seem that what the Buddha taught was pretty obvious. So he speaks of suffering. We all know the first noble truth. The first noble truth of suffering. There is some detail about what this first noble truth entails, but on your first reading of it, it might seem like this is pretty obvious. Suffering. Yes, we all suffer. I mean, it's not rocket science, is it? The first noble truth of suffering? We all suffer. You might even beg to wonder, you know, do you actually need a Buddha to come and tell you that you are suffering? It is said that a Buddha, the arrival of a Buddha only happens, you know, once, what, every so many eons. And an eon is not just a few days. It's not a few months or weeks or years. You know, it's an incalculable period of time. When asked the Buddha on one occasion, "Sir, how long is an eon? Or a kalpa?" I'm sure you'll have come across many a simile in which he refers, because he's never given a number. I don't know whether that was because back in the day they didn't have one followed by however many zeros and had a name for it, but perhaps he thought it would be best if people could be given a simile to understand what an eon was. So he said, if you were to fill a box a compartment that was 16 yojanas. Now you might wonder what that is. Let's just say it's a mile, just, you know, give or take, just to keep it simple. A box that was 16 miles long in length, so length 16 miles, width 16 miles, and height 16 miles. So a box of this dimension, these dimensions, and you fill it with footballs. Have you heard that? If you fill it with footballs? No, he never said that. He said if you fill it with mustard seeds. Yes, if you were to fill it with mustard seeds. And then he says, if you were to empty this box, how often? Once every 100 years, you're only allowed to take how many seeds out of this? Just one. Just one every 100 years. Now consider the time that it would take. Let's just ignore 16 miles. Think about this hall. If you were to fill this up with mustard seeds, we've all seen mustard seeds and how big they are, right? It's annoying when you get one stuck in your teeth. So if you were to fill this hall up, ladies and gentlemen, with mustard seeds, and you were only allowed to take one out once every 100 years, how long do you think it would take you to empty this? And what he says is, in the time that it takes you to empty this container, this box, this compartment of all the mustard seeds, the box would be emptied, but an eon would still have not run its course. So you can imagine, if that is how long one eon is, it is said in the scriptures that this Buddha that we've had, the Gautama Buddha, you know, apparently we have waited 70,000 eons since the passing away of the previous Buddha before we got this Buddha. Can you imagine that period of time? 70,000 eons? I mean, it almost seems like a joke to me. Just the fact that we get to see a Buddha, listen to his teaching. My point is this. I'm not necessarily trying to get across the scale of this. That's not my point here, although it's still fascinating. How come we are here and we have this opportunity to listen to the teaching? Because we have merits to thank for that. We talked about this last time. My question here for this audience today, as we are touching on the point of the Four Noble Truths, it is said that it is only a Supreme Buddha who realizes the Four Truths and then he proclaims the truths so that mankind, humans, devas, brahmas, you know, they can understand it, comprehend it, and then work to free themselves from suffering. But my point is this, folks. If it takes a Buddha to come into this world and to preach us the Four Noble Truths, the first of which is the noble truth of suffering, is that so new to us? Just think about it for a second. By the way, there'll be a lot of thinking to do today. So I hope you brought your thinking hats with you. My teacher tells me that one of the best ways to help someone understand something is to ask the right questions and allow them to come up with their own answers, rather than give them the answers. Let them come up with their own answers, because then that is your own answer. Now I don't have to convince you of that answer. In fact, it makes my life easier as well. So just think about it. Suffering. Any book you take on Buddhism, what's the word that will appear the most number of times? Suffering. Next to that will be Nibbana, freedom from suffering. But suffering is apparently what Buddhism is all about. So much so that I think there will be some people who will be, you know, who will not fancy Buddhism quite, you know, a lot, because it seems like Buddhism is just always going on about suffering, suffering, and suffering. I mean, it seems like such a drain, such a negative philosophy. Does it not seem so? If so, then how come the monks who practice it, the nuns who practice it, they seem to be happy all the time? If all they've understood is suffering, how come they can be happy? So it seems like we are the opposite of what we have understood. Whatever we have understood, we have achieved the complete opposite of that. But the thing is this. Is that the same suffering that we have always known? Did the Buddha have to work so hard to realize the suffering that we have all known our entire lives? The best example I can give you of this is this. Do you remember what he did before he renounced his worldly life? Remember that unforgettable journey that he made with his charioteer? You all heard the story, right? What was his name? Channa. So Channa gave the prince a tour that would change his life forever, as we have read in the books. So when his father, the king, and everyone else in the palace had dozed away, the prince, who had always waited for an opportunity to go and explore what all his father had tried to keep hidden from his young and inquisitive eyes, the prince had an opportunity with Channa. Now you all know how this goes, right? I'm relating this to you not because you've never heard this before. I'm relating this to you because you may not have stopped to ask a question about this before. You know, we are so accustomed to listening to what someone says and, you know, learning by rote. We are so accustomed to that. If the teacher says so, it must be so. We shouldn't be like that. We shouldn't be like that. Even right now, right here, just because I say something, it doesn't have to be so. Because then you don't comprehend. You will remember. But then a computer is better at remembering than you. You can stick more memory on a memory stick than you could ever in your whole life. So this is not about remembering things. In fact, at the end of these talks, let's say you've come along for maybe 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, a whole year, right? Even if you can't remember a word of what I have said, that's still fine if you have understood the truth. So you don't need to remember the prince's name. You don't need to remember all the stories. You don't need to remember Buddhist history. It begs the question, why is it that that's all we learn as Buddhism then? That's okay. I mean, you know, it's history. Interesting. Interesting. I'd say that's pretty much all that is. We learn as young children in school how the prince, as soon as he was born, he walked on the seven lotuses. Right? And the prince, how he lived in a palace, and the luxuries and the treasure and the pleasures that he experienced. And then, you know, we have to remember the Asita Tapasaya, you know, and all this. We have to remember all these names because that is what they asked at the exam. So if you get an A star grade at your Buddhism exam, does that make you a good Buddhist? This is the thing. Everything has become just a means for a competitive edge. I mean, even in Sunday schools, I wouldn't say every one of them, perhaps in some of them, because that is what most parents want. I don't believe for a moment that is what the monks want to impart, but I think that is what we have become. Sorry, I know I'm digressing, but I'll come back, promise. From, you know, once in a while when I get an opportunity, I want to vent my frustrations. I mean, I want to see a different outcome for our people. You know, people who have merits, they deserve better. People who get to come across a Buddha sasana, people who are meritorious enough to be born in the era of a Buddha, they deserve better. They deserve every bit that I have deserved. But today, you know, Buddhism has become, you know, do you know the king's name? Write it down and you get 3 marks for that. Do you know the princess's name? Write it down. Do you know the young prince's name? The heir apparent? Do you know his name? Write it down and you get another 3 marks. Answer all these questions correctly and you get an A pass for Buddhism. But the next thing you know, he goes home and he disrespects his mother. He talks down to other people. He hurts other people's feelings. He steals. And he can't control his lust, his desires. He can't control his anger. But if you ask him, what is the Paticchasamuppada, because it is taught, if I remember right, in lesson number 10 in my grade 13 Buddhism book, you have to say, avidya paccaya sankara, sankara paccaya vijnana, vijnana paccaya namarupa, namarupa paccaya salayatana, salayatana paccaya. But I still remember from my study at school these things. You know, I used to go to Dhamma school. When I went to Dhamma school, see, here's how, you know, my thinking, how it has changed, right? So this is kind of a testimonial to what I thought was Buddhism and how Buddhism was something completely different, what I understand it as now. When I was at school, I was fascinated by Abhidhamma. So we had a teacher who taught us Buddhism. I went to an English Dhamma school, so I got a bit of an experience as to what some of these words I picked up growing up. And then there was Pali, which if you've studied, you're probably still wondering, why did I bother? Because you learnt it at Dhamma school, but then ever since, you've never used it. So you're still probably wondering, why did I bother? Then there was Tripitaka studies, and then there was Abhidhamma. Of all these subjects, Abhidhamma fascinated me the most. And there was a reason for that. One of the main reasons for that was because when I was able to learn by heart all the chittas and the chaitasikas and relate them, I could impress others. And stand out of the crowd. You see how foolish I was? See what I used Buddhism for? If the Buddha knew, that's what I was using, the Dhamma that he had discovered after all that effort, eons of struggling. If the Buddha knew that's what I had learned the Abhidhamma for and used it for, he would have given me a kick up my backside. And I used to walk around like I was holier than thou. You should have seen me back then. Actually, no, you shouldn't have. We probably wouldn't have met today then. I don't like the person I used to be. I was good. I mean, I didn't used to do bad things, thanks to my parents and my teachers who made sure of that. But I used to study Abhidhamma and, you know, learn it all by memory. And I could give you all the 89 or the 121 chittas from one to, you know, the end, and all the chaitasikas, the 52 of them. And I could tell you all of the combinations that you have in the wholesome realm, in the unwholesome realm, and the rupavacharas and the arupavachara brahmalokas. I could give you the war and peace of Abhidhamma. I had it all learnt by memory. Because what I thought was, by the time I get through the end, I would have attained Nibbana. Because I remember still, someone told me that as you learn the Abhidhamma, at one point, because I was aspiring for this moment, I was informed that at one point you're going to start to see the whole world disintegrate. And then come back together again. And then disintegrate. And then come back together again. You're going to see the whole world pulse. So I was waiting for that moment. I was waiting for that moment so much that I think on some of those days, I actually began to see it like that, beg your pardon. That was my hallucination. And then I thought, well, I must have attained something. So of course, you know, if I felt that I had become a sotapanna, then I have to behave like one, shouldn't I? Only later on I realized you can't become a sotapanna by reading a textbook or studying the Abhidhamma. To become a sotapanna, you have to be in the association of one. You have to listen to a preaching of someone who is at least a Sotapanna. But that is not where my head was. Noble association did not play a role in my life. So where were we? Suffering. I'm just saying, you know, sometimes I'll relate these stories because I don't want you to do the same foolish things that I did. It's enough to have one fool in this world, right? We don't need two. So you can learn from the mistakes of my life, so you don't have to make the same mistakes. If you're interested, you can study Abhidhamma, it's fine, but it's not going to get you to Nibbana, that much I can tell you. Nibbana is an internal transformation. One of the best ways to realize, work out whether you're working towards Nibbana and if you're getting closer to it, is ask yourself, am I a better person than I used to be? That is one of the best. It's an acid test. This is one of the best litmus tests you could do. Ask the people around you. Ask your family. Is it more difficult to work with me or is it easier to work with me? What good is a Sotapanna who goes home and he tells his wife, hey, you know what? From now on you should treat me like a Sotapanna. I don't eat like you eat. I need to be served my food on a special plate. And this is my cup, so please don't drink from it because I'm a Sotapanna. This is a Sotapanna's cup. Come on. Let me tell you what my teacher always tells me. If you ever become a Sotapanna, and someone realizes that. In other words, if someone can see a Sotapannaness in you other than your gentleness, your kindness, then you're far from being a Sotapanna. Because the thing is this, if you are become a Sotapanna like that, imagine what the Arahant will be like. I think in today's day and age, people are hiding behind the guise of this robe and claiming to have attained all sorts of spiritual attainments. But then, when you look at their conduct, you know, I won't say more. But it is not our place to judge anybody. So my advice to you is, if there's anyone who claims to be an Arahant, then treat them like one. Let's just say, yes, sir, you are an Arahant, and treat them like one. Because, from your perspective, you'll just be earning merits. So what? But it is a cardinal offense in the Sangha community to claim to have attained noble states when you haven't. And particularly if you do it for gain. So I'm never on this stage going to utter what I'm just going to say now, that I have attained the state of Sotapanna. I'm never going to say that. Or that I'm a Sakrudagami, or I'm an Anagami, or I'm an Arahat. That is not for me to be sharing with an audience. If I ever feel that that has happened, I shall go and speak to my teacher and ask him to check me, give me a kick and see if I get angry or upset about it, hurt my feelings and see if I still get hurt. That's a very private and personal thing. It's not something to be sharing with others. But anyhow, coming back again to suffering. So when the prince went out on his tour, he saw some very interesting things. What did he see? He saw a sick man. Now it is said that the prince had never seen a sick man before, isn't it? It says the prince had never seen a sick man before. This is the first time he'd seen a sick man. And then he saw an elderly man. Well, whichever way around. Elderly man first, sick man later. And then he saw a dead man. And finally he saw a hermit. So now it is said in the books that when he saw these sights, he began to wonder, gosh, life must be full of suffering. So he asked Channa, Channa, who is that? That sir is an elderly man. He's old, aged, soon to be gone. And that sir is a sick man. Does that happen to everybody, Channa? Well, yes, sir. You in your almightiness, you're not safe or free from that. You shall also grow old and you will also die. Now, I don't want to agree or disagree with what the books say, but my question still remains. Do you think that that was the first time the Buddha ever experienced suffering? Do you think, sorry, not the Buddha, the prince. Do you think that the prince never had a moment in his life where he felt frustrated or annoyed or even just angry about something? I mean, here we are talking about a Pratakjana. He was not the Buddha. He was just a very normal human being. And in this discourse that he gives after becoming a Buddha, you know, here's what he says. Idam dukkha pubbe ananusutesu dhammesu chakkum udapadi. He says, this I have never heard before. In the entirety of samsara, I have never heard this saying before. Now, isn't this the same Buddha who, as a bodhisattva, he goes on to relate how much suffering he had to endure? How much hardship he had to endure? So how come then, upon attaining Buddhahood, he says, I have realized a suffering that I have never realized before. Now this prompts us to question our understanding of suffering, does it not? Can it be the same suffering that we all experience? Because if so, do you really need a Buddha? Why do you take refuge in the Buddha? If you have all experienced suffering, why do we need to listen to the Buddha's teaching where he also talks about suffering? Because if, when he says suffering, all we have to say is, yeah, I know. The first noble truth of suffering, and our response should be, yeah, I know. Tell me about it. That's all I do. Suffer. I mean, let's just walk outside, you know, along the poor stricken streets, right? People are poor, they're hungry, they're ailing, right? They have nowhere to live. The beggars on the streets, do they not know suffering? They live in the pangs of poverty. Do they not understand suffering? Do you think a poor man, a beggar, a sick man, an old man, do you think they have to listen to a Buddha's teaching to understand suffering? Is it not pretty damn obvious? Either the Buddha didn't have a clue, he was clueless, or the suffering that he preached and the suffering that we understand cannot be one and the same. It has to be different. Then he goes on to speak about the second noble truth of suffering. And we all know that as what? Tanha, attachment, craving. He says, attachment is the cause of suffering. Yes, it is true. And I think it does not take a lot of convincing for someone to understand that, yes, attachment is the cause of suffering. Let me ask you this question and please give me an honest answer. Would you cry if mother died? No, you didn't listen to my question properly. I said, would you die if mother died? I never said your mother. I'm just saying mother. My mother that you don't even know. You know the queen mother died? Did you cry? And then the queen, she was a mother. She died. Did you cry? No. But she was a mother. You know, mothers die every day. Fathers die every day. Brothers, sisters, they die every day. That doesn't shed a tear. You don't shed a tear. Why is that? Because it is not your mother. Now, you understand this though, don't you? What's the groundbreaking truth there? Again, I have to ask you this question. What is so groundbreaking, what is so paradigm shifting about the fact that attachment is the cause of suffering? Like, duh, we get it. It's no big deal. I mean, I don't think it takes a Buddha to explain to you that it is the things that you attach that bring you suffering. I think it's pretty obvious. And then he goes on to say, the third noble truth of suffering, if you cease attachment, then suffering ceases. Yes. Now, there is of course the noble eightfold path, right? I think that's one of the places where you wonder how does all that fit? This, because there's right view, right thought, right speech, and all sorts of things, right? Now, I think until that point, the fourth noble truth, the remaining three, most people would say just on first inspection, that's obvious. Yeah, it makes sense. So what, was the Bodhisattva thick? Did he not get that? Did it take him such a long time to understand that? So here we come to an interesting juncture where I propose to you this. I don't think that the suffering that the Buddha taught is the suffering that we have understood. I think it's very different. Because upon understanding the Four Noble Truths, he became a Buddha. Now you understand the Four Noble Truths, right? What has happened to you? I mean, just take a beginner's guide to Buddhism book. It will tell you the Four Noble Truths. Having read that, do you feel that you have attained enlightenment? You know, just after you finish reading the last chapter, right? If you see your kid playing in the living room and he throws the ball, it hits the brand new television you brought home, right? And then that topples onto the floor. What happens to the Four Noble Truths then? You probably whack him with the book. See, the truths that the Buddha discovered, the truths that he proclaimed, they transcend whatever truth that we have understood up until now. It is not the same suffering that we talk about. You know, the thing is, you don't even have to be human to understand this general suffering that we're talking about. The thing is this though, when you look at the Paticca-samuppada, it talks about jati paccaya jara, decay. Yep, decay causes suffering. Marana, death. Of course, death causes suffering. But do you even have to be human to understand this? Have you never seen a female dog cry over its dead puppy? Have you never seen that? So what, are you trying to tell me that he's understood the noble truth of suffering? So are you suggesting that then what the Buddha understood was what any beast could understand? You don't even have to be a human being to understand this? See, it can't be so, right? So there has to be something fundamentally different to what the Buddha taught us and what we have come to understand. Here's the reason. True understanding of what the Buddha taught has to be passed down through the noble lineage. You can't simply read the Tripitaka and understand or comprehend the Buddha Dhamma. That is why association with the Sangha is very important. Association with the Sangha is not just giving them an almsgiving, just giving them something to eat for merits, perhaps, but that is not the association of the Sangha. Association with the Sangha is your time that you spend with them to understand the Dhamma, because the Dhamma is your refuge. So this is what we are doing here today. What I have learned from my association with the Sangha. Sangha is, I'm not referring to the robe. When the Buddha was asked, who is the Sangha? He said, Bhikkhu, Bhikkhuni, Upasaka, Upasika. And then he went on to say, you know the Gatha that we recite to worship the Sangha, right? Supatipanno, Bhagavato, Savaka, Sangho. And then you go and say, Yadidan Chattari, Attapurusapuggala. Yeah? So there are 8 individuals who represent the Sangha. These 8, let me share with you, ladies and gentlemen, are not monks. They don't have to be. So are they lay people? No. They are the Sotapannas, twofold, Margastha and Palastha, meaning those who have come, attained the fruits, and those who are on the path. Do you have to be in a robe to be that? Absolutely not. Then Sakrudagami, Anagami, and finally Arahats. So it is a misconception then that the Sangha is necessarily those individuals who are in a robe. So they're not just the monks and nuns. Amongst you, there may be members of the Sangha. But this Sangha, I'm talking about the absolute Sangha, not the conventional Sangha. Conventional Sangha, yes, we are in a robe. But the absolute Sangha, the true Sangha in the Buddha's Sasana, are those who have attained the understanding of his teaching. Those who have realized his teaching. So what is that teaching? The reason that we have not yet perhaps understood this is because we might have studied the Dhamma reading textbooks, maybe studied it online, perhaps listened to a recording or whatever. But what we didn't get to do was association with those individuals who had attained that understanding. That is why our understanding of suffering is very different to what the Buddha taught as suffering. So what did the Buddha teach? You read that book, what the Buddha taught. So what did the Buddha teach then? What did the Buddha entail when he gave the discourse on the noble truth of suffering? What is the suffering that only a Buddha can realize? No other man, Deva, Brahma, can realize this. Without the help of the Buddha or someone who has learnt it from the Buddha. What is that suffering? Because that's what we are trying to understand now. So in fact, what is the noble truth of suffering? You know, you've got to ask the question, why does it say it's the noble truth? What's so noble about it? Old age is suffering, yes, that's a truth. But it's not necessarily a noble truth. What's so noble about that truth? When you're ill, when you have a headache, don't you suffer? Yes, so what's so noble about that? So the suffering that he taught was a very different kind of suffering. So now, let's try and understand what that suffering was. Let's take a few examples. Think for a moment about some of the times you have suffered in your life. Take some recent experiences, if you can remember, which you can remember. Then suffering comes in many forms. I'm now talking about the suffering that we have all come to, you know, we've all experienced. That's suffering, okay? And then I'll show you why that is different to the Buddha's teaching of suffering. So we suffer when people make us sad, or when we are sad, and then we say, people make us sad, don't we? She made me sad, he made me sad, we catch ourselves saying. We suffer when we are disappointed about something. We suffer when we are ashamed, sometimes when we are humiliated. What about when we are insulted? Don't we suffer? If someone insults you in the middle of the street, if someone calls you names, you know, you feel ashamed and you begin to suffer. What about when you are at a loss? Perhaps in business, right, or any other venture you might be in, if you lose something that you like. Perhaps if you lose some property that belongs to you. Maybe you are the victim of theft. Suffer. Perhaps if you have to lose an arm or a leg, maybe a limb Perhaps you've just had an accident and the doctor says, I'm sorry, I can't save your right eye. How does that make you feel in that moment? You suffer. For you to experience that suffering, do you think the Buddha came out of nowhere and just preached the Dhamma to you at that moment? No, it was not the Buddha. The doctor said, we can't save your eye. And then you begin to suffer. So you see, you don't need the Buddha to understand that suffering. Loss from a loved one, or departing from a loved one. And what about the other stuff? Having to be with people you don't like? Which one do you get more of? I don't know, in your lives? Having to be with people you don't like? Maybe it's at the workplace. Maybe it's at home, I don't know. Is there a way you could not suffer when these things happen? What do you think? Is there a way you could not suffer? And in your world, in your picture of who an arahant is, do you think he's someone who suffers when the above happened to him? Do you think he suffers? No, he doesn't suffer. But the same things happen to him. So, in the face of the same adversities, how come one person suffers and the other doesn't? That is one evidence then, that it cannot be that event, it cannot be that occurrence which brings you suffering. I mean, sometimes hunger itself can be enough for us to suffer. Can you ever insult an arahant and make him unhappy? Make him sad, do you think? But have you not caught yourself being insulted by someone and then you began to suffer? Maybe if you didn't have the chance to say something back in return, that caused you even more suffering. You know, you couldn't say your piece. You had to just keep shut. Maybe because they were your senior. Happens a lot. At the workplace, maybe, or when you were children, as parents. When your parents would say something to you, I mean not these days, the parents, they have to keep quiet when the children start speaking, right? But back when we were younger, when my dad starts to speak, I had to keep shut. I suffered. I didn't like getting told off. Who likes getting told off? No one likes getting told off. I suffered. But then I thought, why does my dad make, you know, shout at me? Why is he scolding me? Why is he blaming me? It makes me suffer. If he loves me so much, why is he doing this to me? Today I realize it was virtually impossible for my dad to make me suffer, because suffering is not something that someone else can give me. But just take a moment, folks, and think for now, the suffering that we understand right now, does it not seem like it comes from the outside? Don't you agree with me? Does it not seem like suffering comes from the outside? When the economy crashes, there'll be people who go and commit suicide. I've seen that happen. Because they've lost everything they've earned. And then they lose the will to live. And then they go and commit suicide. I've seen people, especially happens, you know, in the later part of life. Have you not seen where usually if it's just the couple that are left, you know, the children have left home, right? Mother, father, they're now old. Usually if one of the couple pass away, what happens soon after? The other person passes away. And then you say, that's because it was my mother who kept my father happy, but when my mother passed away, there was no one to keep my father happy, so my father also passed away. It was just like, you know, there were two peas in a pod. When one fell out, the other soon followed suit. See, we feel that suffering comes to us from the outside world. There is one kind of suffering that comes from the outside world, just one. And that is physical suffering. That there is no argument about. If this hurts me, it hurts you and it hurts everybody. That hurts us all the same. But there is also the internalization of that pain, which an arahant is capable of not doing. The problem with thinking that suffering comes from the outside is, now we expect other people not to make us suffer. We expect other things not to make us suffer. That is why you sometimes find yourselves begging for other people not to make you suffer. Have you never found yourself saying, please, please don't say these things to me, it hurts me. Why do you talk to me like that? Have you never heard yourself saying these things? After all I've done for you, why do you say these things to me? It hurts my feelings. Can't you understand me? How many years have we lived together and you still talk to me like this? Am I enacting a part of your life? Maybe, I don't know. Am I close? That's alright, been there, done that, bought the t-shirt, I know what it's like. I haven't fallen from the sky. I've lived the life that you have all lived, so I know what life is like. And I want to share with you some of the answers to life's riddles. Sometimes if a friend forsakes you, maybe if someone betrays you, honestly, excuse me, you know, when a boy and a girl, they have a crush, and then they like each other, then they express their desire for each other, and then they get into relationship, right? We've all been there. You know what I'm talking about, right? So I think most of you will be able to relate to what I'm saying. Just think about this for a second. From the moment you start having feelings for each other, you felt that you were on cloud nine when she said, yes, I'd like to be your girlfriend. Excuse me. Okay? You asked her out, she said yes. So that was a moment for celebration. But tell me, no sooner, no later, didn't something like this happen to you? Up until that point, you lived in no fear for what might happen to her or what might happen to him. But the moment that you felt that she was yours, you haven't tied the knot yet, but you feel that she's yours, she's your partner to be, she's going to be your life partner. I say she, you know, you can, the she's here can think of the he's, okay? Otherwise I have to give you both sides of the argument, right? So I'll tell you, you talk about one side of the equation, you can think of the other side. So the moment she said, yes, I would like to go out with you, didn't a fear come into your mind like, what if she betrays me? What if someone else tries to snatch her from me? Didn't these feelings, thoughts come into your mind at least, you know, once in a while? When you held hands and you walked along the street, if ever she pulled her hand away from you, and in that moment you also saw another guy walking up to you, what happens? Tell me what goes through your mind at that time. Suspicion? Fear? Oh my God, am I, what's going on? Why did she just do that? See, maybe you might feel that this is not the moment to ask her about it. But you will start thinking about it. It'll worry you. It'll be a burden to you. Until one day you'll ask her, maybe right at the end of that journey, right? You're going out, you've gone to the movies, you've gone to the restaurant, had a meal, and then right at the beginning, as soon as you left home, she did that to you. And then at the end of the day, when you're ready to depart, or you're dropping her off at her house, or maybe even the following day, you send a text message. You know, hun, I just meant to ask you, you know, it's not like it's anything serious or anything, but I was holding your hand yesterday while we were out. You know, why did you pull your hand away when we saw that guy walk up to us, I'm just curious. It's not like I have any suspicions or anything, yeah. See, from the time that happened to the moment you ask this question, what's going on in your mind? You're suffering. You're suffering. This is a suffering that we call fear. This is terrible. If ever you attach yourself to something, the Buddha says, there's not a moment that passes from that point where you are not suffering. And I will prove that point to you before I leave today. So much so that you will begin to wonder, why do I attach? But you may not be able to stop it immediately. That's okay. At least you have to fall out of love with attachment. Then we can start talking about divorce. But first, you have to fall out of love with it. What divorce am I talking about here? The divorce with attachment. You know, we are also bound to attachment. We don't feel that it's a wrong thing. We don't feel that it does us any harm. Until we begin to understand some of the things that the Buddha has taught us. So here's my argument to you. If ever you find yourself attached to something, there is never, never, not a second passes by where you are not living in suffering. Let me prove this point to you. I'll go back to the girl, because it's a familiar experience for most of us. When you first saw her, let's go back to when you first saw her, you know, that first sight of her, and you thought, she's pretty. Perhaps you were in chemistry class. I know, you don't learn chemistry in grade 2, right? I forget. I have to apply to, you know, the modern day and age, right? I used to preach about chemistry class because I thought, you know, that's when things start to happen. Chemistry happens in chemistry class. But now it doesn't have to, you don't have to wait till chemistry class. It can start from, you know, right at the ripe young age of 7, 8, 9, 10, so on. At this tender age. So anyhow, whenever it happened, right? So you caught a glimpse of her. You know, she was in one of the front seats. You were about two seats back, right? And all of a sudden, she just turned her head. She just wanted to look at one of her friends, but you thought she was looking at you. She jostled her hair, looked at, you know, just by accident, your eyes met. And then you thought, I think she's interested. She's pretty. I'm certainly interested. So in that moment, attachment took over. Now let's see what happens after that. Attachment has now taken over. You know, it's almost like your mind is now hijacked. When an aircraft is hijacked, who has control? The pilot? No. The pilot may be holding on to the, what do you call them? The what? Joysticks. Yes? Joysticks? Okay. Steering wheel. It's not a steering wheel. Anyone know the name for that? Joystick, sir. Thank you. So the pilot's holding on to the joystick. But who calls the shots? Turn left, turn right, up, down, that airport. No, into the towers. Who calls that out? The hijackers. Yeah? So although the pilot seems to be in control, he's not really. When attachment takes over your mind, ladies and gentlemen, you are no longer in control. You have just been mind-jacked. You've been mind-jacked. And you know this. You know this because later you regret. I'm dead certain that there are times in your life, perhaps even every day, where you want to do something else, and there's a lovely saying for this. The mind is willing, but the flesh is weak. Unfortunately, the opposite is true. The flesh is willing, if only the mind will let it. Because it is not the flesh that has been hijacked. It's the mind that has been hijacked. Because when the mind wants something, by hook or by crook, it will find a way to get it. And you know this. As innocent as you might be, as gentle and kind, as generous as you might be, when the mind wants something, do you not remember as young children, when you wanted something, how you find so creative and imaginative ways of getting things? We are still children then, Swami Nuhansa? Is that what you have to say? If that is the case, then we are still children. Yes. So anyhow, you saw this girl, she gave you a what we call a furtive glance, and you reciprocated this. Now in your mind, you want her. So if you're a girl, then you want him. Okay? Now in this moment, here's what happens in your mind. Grief sets in. Now you might think that grief is after you've lost something. Grief is when you don't have what you want. In very simple terms. Tanha jayati soko. Tanha jayati bhayam. So we're talking about grief and we're talking about fear. See, now you'll begin to understand. Whenever there is tanha, whenever there is attachment, you can never be not in either of these two states. You're always in one or the other. And I'm going to ask you the question at the end of this, is it worth it? But let's come to that in a moment. So you saw the girl, now you have feelings for her. You want her to reciprocate those feelings to you, and you feel that there is chemistry between the two of you. Now you wait for the next opportunity. The next time she turns her head, you no longer can read the chemistry on the whiteboard. Your teacher's struggling. She's trying her level's best to try and teach you how to balance that equation. But what's going on in your mind? How can I balance this equation? How do I make it subtly known to her that I'm also interested, but not make it too obvious? Because what if that was just a mistaken glance? I don't want to be looking like an idiot. And I don't want to give it away, because then my friends are going to find out and they're going to start mocking me. You all know this, right? You're not from Mars, are you? No, we're all human beings. We've all lived on the same planet, so we've all been through the same experiences. So we know this. But what has happened in your mind now? There is grief. Grief of what? Grief of not having what you want. See, in this moment, you begin to think that this pain that I experience right now, there's only one person in this world that can heal it. And who is that person? Her. There's only one person in this world that can heal this pain right now. Until that moment that you saw her and those feelings started to appear in your mind, you were cool. You were just fine. You were cool as a cucumber. Nothing bothered you. You were paying attention to chemistry and you were on track to get yourself an A pass in chemistry. But now, things are going to change. Things are starting to change. Because now, she is the center of the universe. Almost on the verge of obsession. Because now if she coughs, you begin to wonder, has she got a cold? Oh dear. Poor girl. But until then, lightning could strike her and you wouldn't care less. You couldn't care less. She could be like struck by lightning. You don't care less. But now if she just coughs, you want to go and give her a cough syrup or a Strepsil. You begin to care. Not because you like her. I'm going to show you how selfish attachment is. I warned you. I'm going to be bursting your bubbles. I warned you in the first sermon. You're still coming here, so it must be that you're prepared for it. going to show you that love is pure selfishness. I also love, but in a very different way. I love expecting nothing in return. But let me prove to you that the love that we have come to see and experience in my previous life, not as in before I was born, but in my life before I understood the Dhamma, I was a selfish love. Because love is like one side of a two-sided coin. What's on the other side? Hate. That's why I always say love is as vulgar as hate. But don't take my word for it. Let's continue this conversation. So now you want her. You want her to look at you. You want her to... It's not just that you want her to look at you, but you also want her not to look at what else? Anyone else. See, until now, she could talk with all the boys in the class. She could smile at them. She could exchange gifts. Maybe she could borrow a book, a pen, a pencil. Maybe she could just, you know, have a giggle and a laugh with anyone in the class. And that was perfectly fine for you. But now, you feel that you somehow have ownership. And now she has to have your permission. No? Let's just fast forward quickly. This relationship, a few years maybe a few months. Do you not recall this conversation where, why did you look at him? Why did you look at him like that? Why was the conversation so long? Did it have to be so long? Why is he calling you now? Who's that text from? What, somehow all of a sudden, another human being who has the freedom of free speech has to now get your permission to talk to another. See? What's crept into your mind now? What has this hijacker done to you? Implanted fear. But previously it was grief. Grief of not having what you want. You wanted something and you couldn't have it. So somehow you approach her. You approach her, you pick up the courage to do so. You sometimes, you know, muster up courage. Your friends tell you, yes, Machan, go and talk to her. It's fine. You know, we are here for you forever. You know, we've always been for you, here for you. Don't you remember? And you say, yeah, you've always been here for me. Let me go and talk to her. And somehow, sometimes, you know, they make that conversation easier, don't they? Easier? Yeah, like so they go and say, hey, he wants to talk to you. So somehow, you know, you approach her and now you go like that. And you pick up the words to speak to her and you say, yes, I know you are I, yes, what do you have to say? I think you are very, very nice. Oh, really? Thank you, says she. Shall we be friends? Here's my number. Can I have yours? So we exchange numbers. Sometimes she might say, you know what? I'm not really interested. What happens then? If you've ever been there, just go back in your down memory lane. Just take a little stroll down memory lane. If you can remember, when you were denied, how did you feel in that moment? When she said, you know, I've got a boyfriend. I'm already going out with someone, not interested. You know, thanks, but no thanks. How did you feel in that moment? Do you not remember how the whole world just began to collapse? Do you remember how your heart felt in that moment? Do you remember that feeling? That agonizing feeling. I know it was just, you know, just playful, you know, it was just a bit of fun. I know, but nonetheless, did it not hurt you? Now the question is, why did it hurt you? You expected her, this other person, to bring you happiness. But in that expectation, hidden behind the veil of this expectation of happiness, what has really come into your life? Only two things: fear and grief. When you approach her, when you ask her, you know, are you interested? Shall we go for a dance? Shall we go for a meal? Right? You're always hoping her to give you an expected answer, right? In other words, everything she says, you match with something already in your mind. When you ask a question, well, you already have an expectation. When I ask this question, I want her to say yes. Yeah? So when she says yes, how do you feel? Elated. But when she says no, how do you feel? Disappointed. In other words, have you not just given her complete control of your happiness? What if she says yes? Okay? Then you feel elated now. Yep. Okay, I'm happy. I like you also. And then 2 seconds later she says, but now what happens? Your heart skips a beat. Oh, hold on. What's going on now? She said, but. What's going on? You know, in the back of your head, you hear all these voices. Oh, no, she doesn't like you. She was just pretending she likes you, but she doesn't like you. You say, wait, let's see what she has to say. But I've got to go ask my parents about this. I'll let you know. So, you went from a moment of pleasure back again to a moment of grief. Now you got to wait until she comes back and says what her parents want for her. Again, it's a waiting game. Can you think of any moment where there was neither fear nor grief? Whenever you get what you want, you go from grief to fear, because you're now living in this fear of what if? What if something happens? What if she changes her mind? Whenever someone says yes to a proposition, are you never in fear that she might say no again? Are you never in that fear? Let's just say, you know, you're doing business with someone and you say, I'm going to sell this to you for this amount of money. Are you willing to buy it? He says, yes. And then the next day he says, no. Isn't that why you sign documents? What does this document help you do? Just gives you freedom from fear. That's what it gives you. The fear of what might happen if they come back with a denial. The fear of what might happen if she says no, if he says no, if they say no, if they turn me down, if they reject me. See, from the moment you begin to want something, ladies and gentlemen, you are always in one of these two states. Either you're in fear or you're in grief. There is never a time when you're in neither of them. So why did I say then that love is selfish? I'll prove that point right here and now. And remember that Swaminarayanse told me this so many months ago, years ago, and oh, I thought he was just making it up, now I realize it. Okay? Usually here's one of the things that people say to each other when they're in love. Here's what they'll say. They'll say, honey, to keep you happy, I will do what? Come on, you've heard this, or you've said this, or a bit of both. I'll do anything. To keep you happy, I will do anything. I will make any and every sacrifice. If it makes you happy, right? I want nothing more. Have you not heard this? I'm not going to ask you, have you said this? Have you not heard this? Yes? All right. Now here's my proposition. So here's a girl, here's a boy. The boy has just said, honey, to keep you happy, I'm willing to do anything. I'm willing to make any sacrifice. She says, sure. He says, yeah. That's how much I love you. I love you selflessly. In other words, what he's saying is, my love is pure. It's not selfish. My love is pure. In my love, all I want is your happiness. Says who? Says the boy. Right. Let's see what's going to happen next. This girl, so she's now with the boy because he's promised her that he's going to keep her happy for the rest of her life. One fine day, she sees another boy. Can't these things happen? It happens all the time. So she sees another boy. They haven't married or anything yet, but he's already made that promise. So she sees another boy, and then she thinks to herself, oh wait, how can I go and tell my boyfriend that there's another boy that I like, because, you know, that would break his heart. Oh, but wait, he told me that all he wants is my happiness. Surely he meant every word he said. He promised me, he swore to me that it is my happiness that means everything to me, and he wants nothing more than that. Then surely I have nothing to fear. Let me go and tell him. I'm proving to you that love is selfish. So she goes, meets the boy and says, Hun, you remember that day you told me something? What are you talking about? You said that you loved me, and for your love, right? Yeah, for your love for me, you will want nothing more than my happiness, that you will give me anything I want if I ask for it. All I have to do is ask. Yes. She says then, well, guess what? I've seen this other guy and I really like him. Do you mind? You wouldn't mind, would you? You wouldn't mind, would you, if I, you know, say, spend Sundays with you and Saturdays with him? If this boy was true to his word, what do you think he should say at this point? Be my guest. Shall I drop you off there? Is what he should be asking. But is that what he says? Is that what he says? Why not? Tell me. Why not? Because love is selfish. What he really meant was this when he said that, honey, if you make me happy, I will always make you happy. That is what he said. But he couldn't get it out of him in those words, because it wouldn't have sounded so sweet and so romantic. To sound sweet and romantic, you have to say, I will sacrifice my whole life for you and give you whatever you want and treat you like a prisoner? No. Treat you like a... I can't help the truth coming out from time to time. Beg your pardon. I will treat you like a princess. Whatever you want, I will get for you. Although that is what I said and it sounded so romantic, the truth was, I will make you happy for as long as what? You make me happy. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a love relationship. This is a business transaction. This is a deal. You scratch my back and I scratch yours. I don't want to offend anyone. Honestly, don't want to offend anyone. But just take a moment, because right now it's just you and I here. Ignore everyone else in this room. You might have come here with your friends, your family, your brothers, sisters, husbands, wife. Just imagine for a second, there's no one here. Just you and I, okay? And don't nod, because they might be looking at you. Just give me the virtual nod. You and I can see that. Nobody else can. Okay? Honestly, every relationship you're in, let's leave parents and children to aside for a second. I'll come to that later, on another day. Okay, let's just leave that to aside for a second. Because that might be just too much for you to take in one swallowing. Okay, so let's put that to aside for a second. Every other relationship, be that friends, right, be that love relationships, okay, every relationship you've been in, you are in, and you hope to be in, is it not always a case of give what they want and they give you back what you want? These relationships will only last for as long as the two parties keep to their word. Meaning, both of these parties are in it, not for the other, but for them. I'm not saying this is evilness. That's not what I'm saying. So don't get me wrong. What I'm saying is, let's come to our senses and understand what's really going on. If you really understand what I'm trying to get across to you, ladies and gentlemen, in the true sense of what I mean, you will not have resentment towards the other party. That is not what I intend from sharing this with you and from, you know, kind of breaking the truth out to you. That's not what I'm expecting. Not resentment, but actually sympathy. And once you begin to realize you're in the same boat, empathy. You will soon begin to realize that actually these feelings of love should really be replaced with empathy. They're in a relationship with you because their mind believes that it is you who has their happiness with them. They believe that. You were with them, are with them, hope to be with them because you believe it is they who have the key to your happiness. It is a pity that it is so in a time and age when the truth prevails. When the noble truths prevail, it is a pity that you believe that happiness comes from the other party. Because when you believe that, the flip side is also true, suffering also comes to you from the other side. See, when you hand over the keys to your happiness to somebody else, what else have you handed over to them? The keys to your suffering, right? The keys to your suffering. So if you have something that I want, you get to decide when I'm happy and when I'm sad. That's a pretty foul deal. So then we have to get into relationship. In other words, a deal. Because if you have, madam, what I have, and I have what you have, now we have to get into this deal where give me what I want, I'll give you what you want. Are you happy with that? Yes. Am I happy with that? Yes. Well, now let's live together. I'm giving you an analytical view of what relationships are. This is the anatomy of relationships. Again, this is not for resentment. This is not to look at the other person and go, you know, don't go home today and say, huh, now I know why you're with me. This is not for that. If that is so, then please don't come to these sermons anymore. I don't want that. That is not what I want. What I want you to understand why they are like that. Why does a mind that can be so self-sufficient, why does a mind that can be happy on its own resort to happiness from another person or another thing or another event? It's because they have not understood how to be happy by itself. If you seek happiness from the outside, if you seek happiness from others, this will always be the story of your life. If you are someone like that, where your happiness is today dependent on someone else's actions, their words, their thoughts about you, right? If it's Valentine's Day and you're waiting for that bunch of roses, if you're waiting for a box of chocolates, what happens if it doesn't turn up? Don't you feel sorry for yourself? Why do you expect someone else to make you happy? And you know, here's the irony about it. Here's the irony about it. When two people come together, they promise each other, I will give you the happiness that you want. Yeah? X promises this to Y and Y promises this to X. Where is the happiness that you own, that you possess, that you have to give to the other person if your happiness has to come from the other person? Do you see the irony in that? That is why I feel really sorry for a guy who gets on his knees and proposes to a girl and say, honey, you know, please, can you say yes? Please, please say yes. I mean, that's what I hear. I read between the lines. This is what I hear. And what is the promise? Please accept my proposal and I will make you happy. Any girl in her good senses should go, dude, you don't look too very happy to me right now. When you are not happy yourself, how on earth can you promise to make me happy? Just look at yourself. No? Just look at yourself. I mean, you're on one knee. How can you claim to give me happiness when you don't have it yourself? If a beggar would come up to you and say, get married to me and I'll keep you rich and wealthy, would you accept that? You wouldn't, right? Why? Because, you know, for them to make you rich, they've got to have it. So a guy who gets on his knees and proposes to you and say, please be mine and I'll make you happy. Just look at his face. I'm not trying to mock people. What I'm trying to do is to get you to sympathize and then empathize. This is how far a mind will go to achieve what it wants. Because when the mind wants something, the mind is in suffering. So here's the noble truth of suffering. Wanting. People think the noble truth of suffering is not having. That is not suffering. Wanting is suffering. A few months from now, perhaps I will give you a much deeper, much more profound understanding of what suffering is. But we have to take it one step at a time. In fact, if you come to the monastery on a Saturday morning, some of the things that we discuss here you might think would be pretty elementary stuff. But that is not to offend or insult any of you. We all started there. It is my responsibility to take you on a journey, right? I can't just come and share with you everything I have realized over the last 6 years of my practice as a monk. I have to take you on a journey, one step at a time. But for now, it's quite safe to understand that the suffering that the Buddha taught is the wanting that appears in our minds. But what do we normally think suffering is? It's when we don't have what we want, we think we are in suffering. In other words, people believe the grief that they experience, they think that is suffering. The disappointments that you experience, people think that is suffering. That is not the suffering that the Buddha speaks of. As I say, you know, we've seen people cry. You know, you don't have to be a Buddhist for that. No matter your religion, a Muslim, a Christian, a Hindu, don't they all suffer when they lose a loved one? So don't they all experience piyehi vipayogo dukko? So do you have to be a Buddhist to understand that and experience that? Clearly not. The departing from a loved one, if that was suffering, then as I said, you don't have to be human for that. Even animals experience that. But what about the suffering of wanting? When you want something, See, now I need you to step into the lab of your life. Because I can keep throwing examples at you, but I need you to think of your own examples. Because your examples are true to you. They're first-hand experiences. I ask you the question, did you cry when mother died? You had to answer no. But did you cry when your mother died? Yes. Because what did you want for your mother to be alive? What about the mother, somebody else's mother? No, you don't particularly want them to be alive or dead. You don't have a preference with that. So therefore, that is not a cause for your suffering. Remember when you walked into the store and you saw something you liked. From that point forward, you wanted it. In fact, if you went and asked them, can I have this? And they say, no, that's the last item. That's just for display. You can't have that. Remember? Sometimes you just did some window shopping and then you thought you wanted it. You walked into the store. Can I have that? No, that's just for the dummy. We don't sell the last item. We have to keep it so that, you know, we'll get new stock in maybe in a week's time. Please, can you give me a call when it arrives? When will you have it? Can I order it online? See, now already you want something, but you don't have it. You think that not having it is the suffering. It's not the suffering. What you're experiencing right now is just what we call grief, shoka. That is not suffering, ladies and gentlemen. That is the aftermath of suffering. That is the product of suffering. Because, you know, that suffering is also caused by attachment. But what attachment causes is not that suffering. What attachment causes is wanting. When you attach yourself to something, when the mind attaches itself to something, the mind wants it. The mind wants it. And when the mind wants something, it can't wait to have it. In that time it waits to have it, how does the mind feel? Anxious? Yeah? That's why you don't like waiting for something. We talked about this, I think, the second or the third talk. You know, why we can't wait for things. Have you ever watched the film Groundhog Day? Anyone? You may raise a show of hands. Groundhog Day? Yes. So that's a story about Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve is on the 24th of December. So in this film, it's always Christmas Eve. Christmas never comes. So what does that mean? When do you get to open your presents? On Christmas Day. Just imagine there are presents under the Christmas tree and you want it to be Christmas Day so you can open up, you can unwrap your presents and find out what someone has given to you, but you can't because it's still Christmas Eve. When it's Christmas Eve, what do you want it to be? As soon as possible, Christmas Day. But what if every day is Christmas Eve and Christmas never comes? How would that make you feel? How about if every day was the day before your birthday? How about if every day is the day before you turn 18? Huh? You want to drive. You can't get your license before you're 18. What if every day is the day before you turn 18? How would that make you feel? Because when you want something, now your mind goes into what we call vexation. Vexation is this feeling of unsatisfactoriness. This agitation the mind feels. And when it feels it, it wants somehow to relieve itself from it. What the mind knows is this: if I want something, I can have it. In fact, what do they teach you at school? What do we learn for science? What do we learn for economics? What do we learn for social studies? What do we learn for physics? And so on. You know what we learn? How we can get the things we want. That's what we learn. That is what we learn for business. How do you get the things we want? But they never teach you how do you stop wanting it. Buddhist history doesn't teach you that. And they say the people who can get what they want are the successful people in life. But here's the thing. Once you get what you want, you are no longer waiting for it. But after you've gotten what you want, now you have to protect it. Because you are now always in the fear of losing it. Let me tell you a nice, a wonderful experience I had a while ago. So this was about a year or two ago. A gentleman came to the monastery. He wanted to take me for drive me to a sermon. And he came in an exquisite, it was quite an expensive motor. Not the motor, but I mean the car. I think it was a Porsche Cayenne or something. Now he wanted to drive me in this to wherever the sermon was going to be. So I got into the car, and as we were driving off, we passed a man who was he's a coconut plucker. So he climbs up coconut trees and he plucks coconuts. So when we had to pull up just to allow another vehicle to pass by, and then there's this man who was walking with his coconuts in his on his back. And so I asked this gentleman who was driving me, "Sir, you got a really nice car, you know, and well done. Do you think this gentleman, this man out there with the coconuts, do you think he understands how valuable this car is? Because if I asked you, you'll probably say this is worth, you know, many millions of rupees. It's quite an expensive car. If we ask this man how much this vehicle is worth, what do you think he'll say? He'll say, well, I don't know. In fact, if he wanted to put down the coconuts, and if he's feeling tired, what do you think he might do right now? Because he was just walking past us. He might lay it down on your bonnet. You don't even let your kids touch your car. But if that man wishes to put down his pluckings, he's going to put it on your car, because he doesn't understand the value of your car. But you value it so much. Tell me then, sir, you bought this car because you thought it was going to make you happy. But now are you not in constant fear of what might happen? For those of you who drive exotic vehicles, perhaps, maybe if you like vintage, maybe if you like antique, maybe if you like driving cars that are quite expensive. Do I have anything against that? No, I told you, when I drive past big houses, I say sadhu sadhu. I love to see that. Because this is evidence that there are people in this world who engage in merits. But here's the deal. Where does that leave you? Do you remember having to park your car, and then you're looking around, especially if it's in the beach side? If you have to park your car, what do you look for? Coconut trees, mango trees, because there are monkeys on them. Because what are you now? In fear. When you drive up and then there's traffic, right, and a vehicle comes close to yours, what do you feel right now? Fear. Fear. If you see a few boys maybe walking up, and they're looking a bit rowdy, maybe, you know, a bit of, you think, oh, they're a bunch of gangsters. They're walking up to the car, right, and they've got maybe some knives or something with them. How do you feel right now? Fear. In fact, perhaps the reason that you're here and listening to the sermon without any fear is because we have security guards out there keeping an eye out for your prized possession. Fear. See, is that what you paid all that money for? To buy fear? You bought the car, but what did they give you for free? You tell me. You bought the car, but what did they give you for free? Fear. And if something actually does happen to your car, Now what have they also given me for free? Grief. So, buy one, get two free. Prove me wrong and I will disrobe right now. I will come home with you and not go back to my teacher. Prove to me somehow, if you can, I dare you, that attachment brings you happiness. Prove to me somehow that attachment brings you happiness, and I promise you I will disrobe right now. Mark my words. Every time you attach to something, all it brought you was fear and grief. Now I know you have something else in the back of your mind. You'll say, but Swaminanda, we do experience pleasure though, don't we? When we have something we like, you know, you talk about the moment, the time we have to wait for something to happen, yes, but when we get it, we enjoy bliss. We enjoy delight, we enjoy pleasure. What about that? I'll come to that. Because you still have a small bubble that is left for me to burst. I'm bursting all the bubbles on the outside. There'll be one bubble right at the end. And I just go prick. And then you'll ask me, Swaminanda, can I also come with you? You know, here's something I'll tell you right now. You've all had the merit to make a start on this journey. See it through. This is an invitation I'm making to you. I will come here for as long as there's at least one person to listen to the sermon. That's fine. I'll make the journey. But each and every one of you have to do this to yourselves. For yourselves. In fact, you will realize that this is the only thing that you will have actually done for yourselves. Every other thing that you will have done in your lives will not be for yourselves. It will be for somebody else. Perhaps it's for your family, your children, your spouse, your country, your village, your workplace, right? For others. Here's the only thing that you can actually do for yourselves. See, today, you may be a well-respected individual in your society. Okay? Perhaps you're a teacher, a renowned teacher, well-respected teacher. Perhaps you're a professional in some other field and you're very respected. You are the best in your profession, perhaps. Don't you still feel sad when sadness comes? Don't you still have nightmares? I don't mean at night when you're asleep. I mean in broad daylight. Aren't there things that still give you grief and fear? Perhaps you're a mother of three children. You know, that is fear times three. When you're out and about with your child, right, or when you send your child to school, right, and or when you put the child in the school van and close the door and say, goodbye, honey, please keep safe. Are you not in constant fear? Because this is your prized possession. I'm not saying give up your children. Please don't. What I'm trying to do is to empower you so that you can have everything you still have today and tomorrow. Because letting go is not something you have to do physically. My teacher has taught me how to keep holding on to everything that I need, but let go in my mind. Letting go is something that will happen in the mind, not physically. Hold on to everything, anything, matters not. Hold on to your children, especially when you're crossing the street. Hold on to them. hold on to your house, hold on to your car, hold on to anything and everything, matters not. Whatever possessions you have today, your Rolex, keep it. You don't have to give it away. Living a simple life is not necessarily about having little. You can have as much as you want. But in your mind, you are unattached. Meaning, there's no fear and there's no grief. There's a way to achieve that. I'm only here to free you from slavery. Slavery from what? The things that you own. Have you seen a man holding a leash and the other end being around the neck of a dog? So a man holding a dog. You've seen that, haven't you? You know what I see? A dog with a leash as holding a man. The dog is the dog. But what does the man live with? Fear and grief for the dog. If it's your pet dog, if you have a pet at home, you live in constant fear. That's why you have to take it to the vet every once in a while. If the dog doesn't eat for 2 straight days, how do you begin to feel now? Because there must be dog lovers among you. I was one. So I know what that feels like. We have several dogs at home. My father was quite the dog lover. He had me and my brother as well. We had a boxer, we had a French bulldog, we had a dachshund, we had a Pomeranian, actually 2 or 3 of them. We had lots of dogs at home. We were dog lovers. So I know what that feels like. But the amount of fear and grief, I had to multiply that by the number of dogs we had. So whatever you possess, it is not the possession that brings you fear. In fact, it's not the objects that bring you fear, ladies and gentlemen. Please try and understand this. So here's what I don't want you to do. I don't want you to go home today and give everything away. That is not what I'm asking you to do. I'm not asking you to go and live the life of a hermit. This life of simplicity is one that you may or may not choose to have at some point in your future. Let that happen if it happens when it happens. There's no rush for that. The sad story is there are more people disrobing every day than there are people going into robes. That's a very sad story. It's a pathetic story. Every time we go to meet the Mahanayaka Thero in Malwatta, he tells us every day he receives at least 5 or 6 individuals who come to him for his signature so that they can disrobe. You know why? Because they gave up their physical possessions but kept holding on to their mental possession. So now they're in a robe, they still want what they left behind. And you can't have it because now you're in a robe. Because there are rules, there's a code of discipline that prevents you from having them. So now what do they have to do? They only leaves them one choice. You have to disrobe. Otherwise you have to do things which are harmful to a monk and almost soil the robe. Disdainful behavior. There are places where that happens. I don't think I need to share details with you. So what I want for you to be able to do is to keep everything you have. That's fine. If you have a nice car, keep it. If you have a big house, keep it. If you live in the lap of luxury, then do so. It's fine. But let's work on our mental attachment. Let's work on our mental approach to it. Let's work on our minds, because it costs nothing to do that. How much do you pay for these sermons? Because the best things in life are priceless. If I charge you for this sermon, you won't be able to afford it. Because I am teaching you the philosophy that will free you from all suffering. And the truth is this, every penny you have spent in your entire life until this moment, you did so to be happy. Yes? Now I'm going to teach you how to be happy for free. So if every penny you spent in your life, you did to be happy, don't you see how much you are willing to pay to be happy? So really, if you are convinced, either now or later, that this is the Dhamma that helps you to be happy, should you not be spending all that money here and offering it to the Sambuddha Sasana? But how much do we charge you? Nothing. If you come to our monastery one of these days, you realize that we never ask for anything from anybody because that is not our way. You know, I only go for alms because I want to take them on an adventure. But at the monastery we live, we have the things we need. The four requisites, we have enough of it. We have a shelter. We have a meal so that we are not hungry. I have two robes, that is more than enough for me. I have my alms bowl in which I take my meals. That's it. Enough. But people like yourselves who come along and then they see, they witness how much people actually gain from this. Now they want to spread this word to others. But I can't preach from here to the other side of the land. For that you have to either take me there or there has to be this camera looking at me, recording it, getting it online, and then someone in Jaffna watching it. But you don't get a camera for free because they're not priceless. They have a price tag. So then people make those offerings. I don't need it. They do it so that people who suffer can find a way to free themselves from suffering as they have done themselves. That is the culture that we have, that we subscribe to. That is our ethos. You will never hear me ask you for anything. I will never say that because I am not here for anything. I am only here to give you. I have experienced most things that life can offer, can afford and life can offer. But I have realized that none of those things make me happy. Happiness can only be found in the truth. That is the Dhamma that I share with you. Today I have realized how to free myself from wanting. I used to want a woman to be by my side to keep me happy. I used to want someone to smile at me. I used to want someone to talk to me to keep me from feeling boredom. I used to want someone to keep me from feeling lonely. Don't you experience loneliness in your life sometimes? I mean, in this day and age, it has become an almost pandemic. It's almost epidemic even. Loneliness. Because people are far too glued to their handsets, their mobile phones, their computers, that people don't have time for each other. I can't change that because that is the world is going to be. That's the way the world is going to be and will forever continue to be so. Because people are getting more and more hectic and they're getting more and more consumed by the advancements of technology and so on. So I can't create a world for you where you will always have someone to be by your side. I can't promise you that. But here's what I can promise you. I can help you work on your mind so that you don't want anyone to be by your side. That's not to say I want someone not to be by my side. That's the opposite of that. That's not what I mean. You will be free from that wanting. So if there is someone, then so be it. If there is no one, then so be it. But what happens to a lot of old people? I used to work in a care home, so I know this, I've seen this. On many occasions, I wanted to be a doctor. I think I shared some of these stories with you in the first or second sermon. I wanted to be a doctor, and to be a doctor, medical doctor, you have to get yourself some experience while we were in the UK. So I went and worked in a care home for a good number of years. And there I used to wash people and dress them and feed them. Old people between the ages of 70 and sometimes 90, even older than that. on more than one occasion, people have died as I was washing them. I didn't kill them, but I promise. They were so old. And sometimes, you know, terminally ill. So I have seen what loneliness can do to people. Every day, I remember Frank, every day he used to ask me, "Is my family coming to see me today?" I'd say, "Yes, Frank. They said they'll come after lunch. So let's get you dressed up, right? And we can be nice and I'll keep your room ready and everything, so that when your family comes, when your daughter comes, you can talk to her all afternoon." So he'd be very excited. Frank was 78. He'd wait for his daughter every day. Why every day? He had dementia. So every day I could make him a new promise, the same promise I'd made him the previous day. "Yes, Frank, your daughter's coming today." I think that is what kept him alive, at least for the last few months of his life. The hope that his daughter would come. In other words, the wanting to see his daughter. You know, they say hope keeps you alive, right? What a pity. If you need hope to be alive, if you need hope to stay alive, ladies and gentlemen, what a pity. I don't want any of you to be like that. I want you to be independent. I want you to be free. I want to empower you so that there's no one in this world that can make you unhappy or disappointed. Frank's daughter always disappointed him. Because every night I would put him to sleep after giving him his drugs and having given him his dinner. I'd say, "Frank, oh, it doesn't look like your daughter's coming today, but I'm sure she'll come tomorrow. So let's wake up early in the morning. I'll come to see you in the morning. I'll dress you up and wash you, and we'll wait to greet and meet your daughter." And on some occasions he'd ask me to ring his daughter on his behalf. So I'd pick the phone and dial the number and pretend I'm talking to his daughter when I'm actually just talking to the nurse on the other side. I say, "Frank, here, your daughter wants to speak to you." Because the daughter is far too busy to answer the phone calls. Because she believes she's done her duty. She's washed her hands. You know why? Because that is how they grew up. Dear parents, if you don't instill the value of looking after your parents, loving for them and caring for them in your children today, very soon you will end up being Franks. Don't tell me I didn't warn you so. Because that is the culture in which they grew up. Their Frank's children grew up in a culture where all the parents had to do was to feed the children, educate them, shelter them, give them something to wear, right? And take them to the doctor when they were ill. You know, just provide for them. Frank never taught his children the virtues of respecting and looking after their parents. He never taught them those virtues. He never taught them the values of parental relationships. He never taught them that. So they were just children. Just human beings. So, you know, when we spoke to Frank's daughter, she often used to say, "You know, just tell him that I don't have the time to come. You know, I'm far too busy. If I'm paying his nursing home fees, what else does he want me to do?" This is Frank's daughter. Because that care home was one of the best in town. So they actually had, you know, the best facilities. But that's not what Frank wanted. You had an attached bathroom. You could order any food that you wanted. All you had to do was order. But Frank couldn't remember what he had last night. So every day he would order the same thing. He'd say, "Today I want to try something different." I and he would order the same thing he'd ordered the last night. But they were paying for his fees, the fee to be in that home. It was very expensive in that care home. Almost £5,000 per month. That's pretty expensive. That's 60,000 per year. So she'd say, if I'm providing for him, what else does he expect from me? I don't have the time to come and see him, because I've got my family to look after. Can you please explain to him? I said, dear madam, could you kindly talk to him? Oh, yeah, just pass me the phone. And then I could hear her. Hello? Yeah, daddy, I don't have the time to come and see you, okay? I'll come tomorrow. Just don't trouble people, okay? Just be good, all right? And Frank would ask, when are you coming to see me? That's all he wanted. But that's the problem. He wanted. He wanted. And he thought suffering was his children not coming to see him. Do you think Frank had understood the first noble truth of suffering? What he was going through was Piyehi Vipayogo Dukko. He wanted to be with someone he liked, he loved, but he couldn't. He thought that was suffering. That is not suffering. The suffering that the Buddha taught is very different. Wanting, ladies and gentlemen, is the suffering. Now here's what I want you to do. I want you to do. So that's also wanting, yes. Here's what I want. Here's what I need you to do. Okay? Over the course of the next week, and please try and do this, because this will help you to progress on your path and we can have a fruitful conversation next time we meet. Over the course of the next week, whenever things happen in your life that brings you some suffering, it could be you're angry, disappointment, sad, frustrated, annoyed, right? Do you think you'll not have any opportunity for that? Is this going to be a very difficult experiment to do? Perhaps? No. So there'll be ample opportunity for you to experience this. Here's what I want you to do. In those moments, ask yourself, is it the event that's making me unhappy, or is there something I want out of this that is making me unhappy? Say, for example, your children promise, Dad, I'm going out, I'll be back by 9. So now you're waiting for 9. 9 comes, but your daughter doesn't come back home. So as any good parent, how would you feel at this point? Fear. So if you resort to your normal behavior, at this point you'll normally pick up the phone and give her a call. Maybe the first time you'll say, Dua, what time are you coming home? It's already past 9. Where are you? So you'll hear a few lies from the other side. We're just outside, Daddy. Outside what? Don't ask me that. But you're now in fear. Right? When you experience this moment of fear, address that issue as you normally would. Right? I'm not here to give you instructions or advice on how you should deal with that problem. But here's what I also want you to do. Ask yourself, why are you feeling fearful right in this moment? Is it because your daughter hasn't come home, or is it because you want your daughter to be home? What if you didn't want that? What if you didn't want that? So if you didn't want that, shouldn't your daughter be home at 9? She should. Still, she should be home because you have a duty. Because this is a question I get quite a lot from parents and other people. You know, Swami says, when you give up all these wants, if it does happen, you know, through our practice, then are we just going to live like robots and not care about the people that live with us? Will I not care about my children? Is it going to be that they can come home at any time they want, because then they're going to ruin their lives? No, that's wrong. That's not what I'm saying. To look after your children, ladies and gentlemen, what you have to do is fulfill your duty as a parent. Fulfill your responsibility as a parent. Fulfilling duties and responsibilities is one. Suffering is another. You look after 2 kids that you have at home. I look after 450 people at our monastery. But I don't suffer. And they're doing just fine. But we have rules. We have discipline. There's a way we do things at the monastery. There's all that because that is my responsibility. It's my duty. I fulfill my duties, I fulfill my responsibilities. When your child is ill, right, is it your suffering that will cure the child, or is it you fulfilling your duty and taking your child to the hospital and getting it some medicine that's going to cure the child? Which one? Suffering? Or doing your duty? Doing your duty. So, let's do our duty. Let's fulfill our obligations. Let's do our responsibilities. But we don't have to suffer. Fear and grief is all that wanting will bring. Nothing else. Nothing else. I promised you, prove me anything else that wanting will bring and I will disrobe. I'll keep true to my word. Wanting does not bring anything other than fear and grief. But you do know there are things in life you want, right? So here's my task to you again. Over the course of the next week, as you live life, as things happen to you, right? Whenever you feel disappointed, annoyed, frustrated, you know, someone makes a promise and they don't keep, they keep make an appointment and they don't turn up, right? Someone borrows something from you and they say, I'll give it to you tomorrow, and they don't. Someone borrows some money from you and you ask, you have to keep asking them, when are you going to give it back to me, and they don't. Maybe it's a brother, maybe it's a sibling, maybe it's a friend. You know what life is like. You know, this is life. Someone insults you, someone shouts at you for something, for no wrong you've done, right? And that makes you sad. When these things happen, dear ladies and gentlemen, what I want you to do is, when you experience that moment of suffering, take a moment and ask yourself, am I suffering because of the event, or am I suffering because I want a different outcome? In that moment, you will begin to comprehend what I have shared with you today. So that is going to be your homework in the lab of life. What I give you will make sense 20% while you are here, but the remaining 80 will happen as you apply it. Buddhist philosophy is for application. In fact, you could call this applied Buddhism. Like we've done applied math, this is applied Buddhism. That's why it says out there, a practical approach to Nibbana. Nibbana is practical, if nothing else. So can we all make an effort to try and do that over the course of next week? Because then when I continue the conversation the following week, you will be able to relate to what I'm saying better with those experiences. Alright. I think it's time for us to bring today's talk to a conclusion. And finally, I want to thank you all for keeping to my request. So last week, you were all lined up to offer alms to the monks, and you gave something very special. You know what you gave? The gift of giving. You'd taken extra effort, you'd gone all the way, and the trouble, I noticed on some occasions, to cut a sandwich up into squares, I think they were 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. And I loved you for that, for doing that. Because you were so kind as to not fill up the alms bowl so that we could go around on alms and give other people a chance to earn some merits. Even last week we had the fantastic opportunity to go and do that service to some really poor people. They live in much hardship and poverty, and because I can't take more than I can consume in the day, because I don't want to waste anything, Everything is precious. So they provided us, you gave them the opportunity to make an almsgiving. Whereas if you fill the alms bowl, as soon as I step out, then I can't go in an alms round on that day. So for all the thought that you had put in on their behalf, I think that was a gift that you gave them. And for that kindness and thoughtfulness for all of them, I salute you. And hats off. Well done. Thank you very much for thinking about someone else in your desire to engage in merits. You've also given someone else a chance to do that. So well done, all of you. All right. Let's transfer the merits we have all acquired and bring today's talk to a close. Excuse me. Let us all take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem and listening to the Dhamma and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, since time immemorial, who have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief priests of all of the chapters who have committed themselves to the betterment of all sentient beings and to the noble path. Let us also remind ourselves that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by translating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. And may by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, our employers and employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. And may by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical or mental ailments which impede them on their path to salvation. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Samudhasasana. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And by the power of these merits, they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. May all those who lost their lives in the war, be their friend or foe, rejoice in the merits we have acquired today. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who might have lost their lives from natural calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, forest fires, pandemics and so on. Let us remind ourselves that in this infinite long journey of samsara, they will have all been our mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, teachers, friends and so on. For all that they've done for us, let us take a moment to be grateful to them, and by the power of these merits, may they be freed from any woeful plains that they might have been born in. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, by the virtue of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become an arahat unvahanse, or an arahat teranin vahanse, in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha himself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginne idatnva Dvesha ginne idatnva Moha ginne idatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetna Mamada siyalu loka Siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetna Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapala beva Nivan sapala beva
තුන්වන්ගේ සූවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්ත්වයන් නිබාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛතර වෙත්වා සාදු සාදු සාදු